Running up a structure at scale is hard. It's messy, it's complicated, and it has a tendency to go sideways in the middle of the night. Rather than talk about the idealized versions of things, we're going to talk about the rough edges. We're going to talk about what it's really like running infrastructure at scale. Welcome to the Real World DevOps Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Julian, editor and analyst for Monitoring Weekly and author of O'Reilly's Practical Monitoring. All right, folks, I've got a question. How do you know when your users are running into show-stopping bugs? When they complain about you on Twitter? Maybe they're nice enough to open a support ticket? You know, most people won't even bother telling your support about bugs. They'll just suffer through it all instead. And God, don't even get me started about Twitter. Great teams are actually proactive about this. They have processes and tools in place to detect bugs in real time, well before they're frustrating all the customers. Teams from companies such as Twilio, Instacart, and CircleCI rely on Rollbar for exactly this. Rollbar provides your entire team with a real-time feed of application errors and automatically collects all the relevant data, presenting it to you in a nice and easy readable format. Just imagine, no more grepping logs and trying to piece together what happened. Rollbar even provides you with an exact stack trace linked right into your code base, any request parameters, browser, operating system, and affected users, so you can easily reproduce the issue, all in one application. To sweeten the pot, Rollbar has a special offer for everyone. Visit rollbar.com/realworlddevops, sign up, and Rollbar will give you $100 to donate to an open source project of your choice through opencollective.com.
Hi, folks. Welcome to the Real World DevOps Podcast. I'm here with Emily Freeman, cloud advocate at Microsoft. Welcome to the show, Emily.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So for the folks who aren't as familiar with developer advocacy or developer relations or developer evangelism or the 50 bajillion other names that it might go by, can you tell us what is it that you do? What are you doing for Microsoft?
Yeah, absolutely. Along with the 50,000 names for developer relations, there are also 50,000 interpretations of the actual job. And so it will vary company to company and person to person. But for me and Microsoft, I like to say that because I have a background in writing and I was a writer before I was a developer, that I like to tell stories. And my job is to tell the stories of the developers in the communities I am in and serve and represent. The most important role I think I play at Microsoft is bringing customer feedback back to the product teams. So when I go to a conference, I am never one to just like helicopter in, give my talk, and then peace out. I think that's just poor form. And it doesn't benefit anyone at that point but my ego. And so my job really is to go and talk to people and to hear all their feedback, positive and negative, right? And it's not personal. It's about making the product better for the community.
That sounds like a much more reasonable job than you would hear from like reading shit shows on Twitter.
Yes, absolutely.
And that might be a good segue to the recent total shitstorm that happened on Twitter about developer relations. I don't even know how this thing started. It just suddenly appeared one day.
Yeah. And the criticisms from this last one aren't new. And this is just one iteration of the sort of DevRel hate,
right?
Which is like on a very personal point, it's hurtful because it's like, okay, this is my work. This is what I care about. I'm passionate about this. And I dedicate all of the time I spend at work to this role. And so to hear that it just has no value or, that we are simply, you know, low-key Twitter celebrities that are company shills and drink champagne on planes and party.
That sounds like a fantastic life. Can I get that job?
I know. I was telling someone, I'm going to Milan next week for Microsoft Ignite the tour. And it's very exciting. I've never been to Italy. I'm thrilled. And I was just telling them, like, I sound a lot cooler than I am. Like, oh, I just got back from Toronto and I'm going to Milan. And I'm like, no, I'm just on the plane, sad. but yeah, the travel is part of it. I think it's the part that people cling on to. Mm-hmm. I also think that we as an industry have not done a great job recently at actually representing what the work is. I think so much of the emphasis has been around Twitter and a lot of the developer relations folks, especially the people Microsoft is picking up, have really, if not enormous Twitter following, substantial ones. Mm-hmm. And I think
they're already super well-known people to begin with
yes.
in their own right.
Yeah. But there's a cult of personality thing happening.
Yeah.
And I think when we have that, and when we focus so much on the persona and that sort of Twitter platform, then we lose the actual benefits of developer mm-hmm. relations, both for the community and the company that they work for.
Yeah. So some of the criticisms I saw, you alluded to this one, that you are the representative of a company, but you're when you're speaking on behalf of the company, you're not saying that you are. And therefore, it's kind of like influencer stuff, but you're not saying that you are. Like, you're not divulging where you're getting your pay from. To me, this sounds like a kind of a dubious argument, because your employer is right there in your profile.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty open about any employer I've had. So I think everyone knows I work for Microsoft. And certainly when I go speak somewhere, Microsoft's logo is on right. the deck. I will say that I'm a cloud advocate for Microsoft. That's probably all I'm going to say about Microsoft. And I think that's, that's the important thing, right? Unless it's a Microsoft event, I am not applying to like a DevOps days and mm-hmm. saying, let me talk about, you know, Azure DevOps. That doesn't benefit anyone. Yeah. If I think Azure DevOps can do something really cool with a different storyline, like an actual problem set that I think the community is struggling with, awesome. If I think another tool that Microsoft does not own can do it better, I'm going to talk about that. So, and we were all hired by Microsoft with that understanding that we represent specific communities. We target our talks to those communities, and we are not going to be just a different version of a sales engineer.
And at the end of the day, your job is to help build a product and help build a community around the product. Like yeah. you're bettering both sides.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's sort of like the middleman where we get the negative parts of both sides. You know, it's like
right.
we're sort of stuck in the middle. Like, we're trying to make things better.
Yeah.
And everyone's kind of mad.
Hey, someone else and myself also kind of waded into this whole storm. I look at developer relations in a much more foundational sense mm-hmm. of basically everyone in the company is there to do sales in some capacity.
I agree.
My job as when I was working in ops and SRE was to help build a product so that we could sell more of it. Mm-hmm. The job of developer relations is to be out there in community, building community, bettering the product so we can sell more of it.
Yes.
Like, we're all here to sell more stuff.
Yes. Yeah. So
to me, when I see developer relations get up on a stage, it's like, oh, they're on stage. They're clearly here to sell me more stuff. But like, I don't take that as a negative. Like, yeah. I know their goal. Like, if they weren't here to sell more stuff, they wouldn't be on stage to begin with. Like,
yeah.
Their role wouldn't exist.
Yes. And it's not a direct link, right? It's right. not like, to be very clear, no one in developer relations has any kind of sales metrics or are measured by that. We get no rewards based on that. There's no direct link between, okay, if you buy Azure, then I get a bump. That's just not how it works. So you're right
yeah.
in that everyone is supposed to, you know, we all work for a company.
Right.
We get paid because they make money. And so if you're a purist and just want to develop but think that, you know, you don't need to worry about the end user, that's just, I mean, not being realistic, I think.
Right. It still doesn't work. Even as an engineer, mm-hmm. Yeah, you're building a product, but why are you building a product? So that you can sell more of the product. Like,
yes.
Even engineers don't have sales goals. They're not measured on how much product was sold. But if sales go down, they lose their job.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's very much the same in developer relations of you are playing the long game. Mm-hmm. You're building a community because the community will become self-sustaining and grow the company over time.
Yes.
So yeah. When you're looking at it, it's not like you're not a salesperson. You're not trying to meet a quota for this quarter.
Yeah.
You're thinking, how can I build something that people actually want, that mm-hmm. people really want to be part of this community for the long haul, for yeah. years at a time.
Yes, absolutely. And I will not promote a product I don't believe in. Like, I'm not going to get up there and say like, right. yeah, this is this awesome product. When in reality, I'm thinking like, what a shit show this is. You know, that's not my style.
That would be really hard.
It really would be. Yeah, that would be, I mean, I feel like, I don't even think great salespeople do that because you have to sort of believe in that and you have to be honest with your customer. Mm-hmm. And if I mislead someone, they're not going to trust me again. So I'd rather be honest and be like, that's not a great product for you. That needs help. Let's go use this other thing and have them come back and trust my word and my reputation. That's important to me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, I've been having a lot of conversations lately about like the Microsoft we all know and hate and the Microsoft of today.
I know.
Like I was at dinner just recently and someone made the comment that you should go to Microsoft. They're a much better company. And I'm like, yeah. I'm sorry, what? I know. When did that happen? What universe is this?
I know.
You mentioned what got me thinking about that is you mentioned there are situations where you won't recommend Microsoft products because even though you represent Microsoft, their products may not be the right solution for you.
Yes.
It reminds me of the old Microsoft certification exams of like the answer to everything is this Microsoft product.
<That's> so <amazing.
laughs> everyone would have this problem, but especially people in the industry, like, yeah. Well, there's the right answer. And then there's the answer the test is looking for. And they're not the same.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think so much of the emphasis at Microsoft right now is changing that perception and actually living up to the new vision and the new goal that we want to have as a company.
Yeah. I think which is just impressive.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It is impressive. Satya has done a great job at setting that vision and then making sure that people at Microsoft understand that and sort of live that every day. Obviously, like we're a big company and there are faults. I don't want to say that everything's unicorn and rainbows. Like, yeah. It's a work in progress, but aren't we all?
Right.
But yeah, absolutely. It's funny because I think 10 years ago or so, Microsoft was actively undermining open source communities.
Yeah.
And now it's one of the largest, if not the largest, open source contributor. And so they're doing a lot of work around that. I wonder sometimes if some of the developer relations controversy is affected by the fact that all these corporations who are now hiring a bunch of developer relations folks who come from open source are then like either acquiring the open source or getting more involved in the open source. And there's this sort of fear of conflict of interest.
No, I could absolutely see that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I think you might be on something there. I don't know how much that plays into it, but I think there's some truth there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that a lot of it's just fear-based and it's like, here's these mega corporations. We're also in this acquisition season where the really big corporations are acquiring all those like medium companies. and that gets always a little scary because then it's just, oh, there's five companies. Okay.
Right. All the 50 bajillion dollar companies are acquiring the 10 bajillion dollar companies.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And may we all make some money off this, please.
Yes, please. So on a completely unrelated note, I heard you're writing a book.
I am indeed. I am writing DevOps for Dummies.
That sounds awesome. My condolences and my congratulations.
I see you've written a book, sir.
I have also written a book. I know the pain, so I'm not going to ask you how your book is going, lest you punch me through the phone.
It's true. I think we all have those friends that are like, oh, how's the book going? Are you making tons of progress? Are you excited? And then you're just like, no, none of those things. I'm not making any progress. I feel sad. I actually don't want to talk to you anymore. Where's a drink?
Been there.
Yeah, it is the hardest thing I have ever done. I don't know how to describe it. I think all authors or all people who have attempted this get it, but it's incredibly difficult to convey just how difficult it is.
Yes, I've had that same struggle. I've read several books by like Stephen King wrote On Writing, where he gets into that. Stephen Pressfield wrote the War of Art. It's the same idea. And then Anne Lamott, who lives in the Bay Area and is absolutely wonderful, wrote Bird by Bird, which is kind of the same thing, but for creative writing. Nice. And all of them talk about the same idea of writing sucks.
It's awful.
Like there's a quote by some authors, like writing is easy. All you got to do is slice your wrist and bleed out.
and then it's done.
And, then right. and then it's done. Like, it's just that easy.
Yes.
So writing a book is hard. And I just realized, I don't think we've mentioned the title of your book here.
Oh, we did briefly. DevOps for Dummies.
Okay. It is
DevOps Focus through Wiley, the standard yellow dummies book.
Yeah, yeah.
It will be a high level book because it is.
Sure. So why another DevOps book?
Well, there's not actually a ton of DevOps books. Like, when you actually look at it, there are the really well-known ones, right? Mm-hmm. But when you look at the actual authors, it's like 10 people. and so I think it would be my pitch to Wiley was, one, I don't think there's a ton of work done for the sort of dummy or the beginner or the manager or the developer who knows nothing about operations but has sort of heard of DevOps and wants to kind of see this. I do think that DevOps is still very ops focused. Mm-hmm. And I think when you go to DevOps Days events or any of these sort of DevOps focused communities and you ask, like, are you a developer? Are you an operations person?
You're running mostly sysadmins.
Exactly. Exactly. And so I think it's really interesting sitting between those two communities, because a lot of operations folks express their concerns to me about, well, I don't know how to code. And obviously, like, I can't, how do I evolve? What's this place for me in the future, especially with cloud? Like, am I losing my job? Is this no ops, which I think is absurd. and then the developers, interestingly, have the opposite fear, right? I can develop, but I don't know how the systems run. I can't deploy. I don't know what to do. It's AWS is big and scary. Azure is confusing. Mm-hmm. All of these things. And so I think it's interesting to bring those communities together. But because I have a development background, I think I bring a unique perspective that some of the other books just haven't had, because they're written by ops folks.
Yeah. I love that pitch. So what sort of stuff would be covering in the book?
So I broke it down into like 5 parts, with very much the DevOps focus of like people, process, tools. And so the first part is more focused on like getting started in DevOps. Like, so you've heard about this DevOps thing. This is what it is. It's sort of born out of Agile. It's an evolution. How to transform your organization to start thinking like this, how to get people on board, finding internal evangelists. And then we kind of get into the development lifecycle and making sure that DevOps is integrated into every step. So I've kind of brought it down into, let's look at this linearly, and then let's create a cycle around this and to center the customer within that cycle. Mm-hmm. And then to kind of round it out, how you can tool or add tools to your pipeline.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good. Like, I love how you've broken that down.
Thank you. I'm glad you're enthusiastic. So one of the things
about one of us has to be. What? One of us has to be, right?
I know. So this is one of the. I try to be really genuine and open and honest about this process. But one of the weird things about writing a book is, like, I'm halfway through. And when you go through these cycles, right, where it's like you get excited about it. It's like, okay, this is good. Oh, that's a brilliant idea. Yeah, write that down. This is great. Oh, no, that's terrible. Why? I'm unqualified. I should really just get out of tech. Gene Kim's going to cry when he reads this. Yeah, it's this weird cycle. So I'm constantly thinking like, yeah, I think this is good, but maybe it's not. And in some beautiful irony, you cannot DevOps a book. It is a waterfall process.
Absolutely.
I write it and then people decide whether it's great or shit. And then I find out. And if it's bad, you can't rewrite it. You know, mm-hmm. you only get to rewrite it if it's good, which is funny, I think.
It is funny. I mean, funny in a, oh God, kill me sort of way.
Yes, absolutely.
So O'Reilly, who I wrote my book for, they modified the traditional process a little bit. Mm-hmm. So you write several chapters, basically half the book, and then it goes off for an early release. And then you're supposed to solicit feedback during this period. And they also send the entire draft to technical reviewers, people in the community that are practitioners and are good at whatever it is you wrote the book on. Mm-hmm. So for example, I was one for Jason Dixon's Graphite book. So nice. I read that book. I was there while he was writing and providing technical feedback on it. And then he had several other people also doing the same thing. And same thing for my book. I think I had like six different people, all fantastic, well-known people in the industry that were providing feedback on it. And I got this as I went through, which was really, really helpful.
That's awesome.
Right. Yeah. And then like by the time you get to the final draft, the community has already seen it. So like you have some feedback, but it's still not as great as you would want. Like at the end of the day, like you're just writing a bunch of words and you're hoping they make sense.
Yeah.
And I was talking to my editor. I would love to write a second edition of mine because my book doesn't include a bunch of information that I wish it did.
Yes.
Just due to time constraints.
Yes.
So like my book doesn't talk about observability. I don't even think the word is in the book at all.
Yeah.
And like that is kind of dumb and people are asking me about it, but you can't do a second edition unless the first one sold well.
Exactly.
And like, that's really dumb. Like I want to do a second edition because I can do it better than the first.
Yes, absolutely. And it will be better than the first. I think that was your first book, right?
Yeah.
So I think one of the struggles I've had as a first-time author is just recognizing that Mary Thangvall actually put this best. She was like, I was having a total panic attack and I called her and she was like, you are writing a book on DevOps, book on DevOps. Yeah. Like you're not the first, this isn't the Bible, calm down. but I think just the difficulty of actually getting it out is such a hurdle that you're never going to be satisfied with it. Mm-hmm. You want to make those changes and updates.
One of the biggest struggles I had, I don't know if you've experienced this. Like I would sit down and I would look at my notes and be like, oh man, I have this great idea. I know exactly what I want to say. It's just rolling around in my head, sit down, bang it out. And then you look at the paper like, wow, that is absolutely nothing like what I meant to say.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great process. I had this tweet at some point, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was like the process of writing a chapter. It was like, you know, think about it, have existential crisis, write a little bit, hate everything, drink too much, write some more, love it, feel confused, brace for editor feedback. I'm like, I think that's apt. I think that's that's pretty much the process. So yeah, it's a fascinating thing to do. I think from every author I've talked to, it is absolutely worth it. Mm-hmm. It'll be great. Such outside of the benefits of like creating a platform for yourself and a personal branding thing. It is really good as a learning process and actually
absolutely,
you know, stretching some of these these atrophied muscles with just it's a marathon. That's, I think, what the hardest part is. It's a marathon and there's no rewards.
Yeah. Like you just keep grinding.
Yes. Yeah. It is an absolute grind until it's over. And then you're like, I hate this whole thing. I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And then they're like, promote it.
And then the real work starts.
Exactly.
It took me 19 months for mine start to finish.
Dang. Okay.
And that was about 40,000 words, 45,000.
Dang. That makes me feel better.
Yeah, like it was everyone. So this is one of those things that when you talk to publishers, you say, well, how long does it take to write a book? And they're like, oh, about 6 months. And you're like, no. When you talk to authors, they say, no, the average book, nonfiction book, takes about 2 years to write.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so there's this huge disconnect between what the publisher is telling people and what the authors are actually doing.
Yes.
But no one's really talking about it.
No. And I think the publishers have caught on to the fact that they have to put arbitrary deadlines in to stress us the fuck out. So then
I'm pretty sure O'Reilly did that to me because my original contract said the book would be draft complete in like 3 months.
Same.
And I'm exact like, same. Yeah, I'm like, there's no way that's going to happen.
No.
I don't think I hit draft until like 14 months.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that works. No, we just, I just talked to my editor who's fantastic. He's great. and he just pushed it back. And editors play a really funny role because they're like a coach in that they have to push you, but not so hard that you break. So it's like this, like, you need to get this done, but also we love you and it's okay.
One of the things that really pushed me was when they asked / threatened to get me a co-author.
This, oh my God, they all play this game. There's a run book. There is a publisher run book.
I think there is.
That is hilarious. Yeah, they said like, you know, if it's not done, or if the, it's not like 75% done by March or something, we gotta get a co-author. And I was like, no.
Yeah, that was my response too. I'm like, no, I got this.
Yeah.
Give me a little bit more time.
I know. Mostly because I don't want to have emails back and forth arguing about things. I'm like, I will just get this out.
Yeah, it's like, let's spend the time arguing what DevOps means instead of writing about it.
Yes. Yeah. Which is a very tech thing.
I think. Of course.
That's how engineers write books, I think.
Yeah. When I look at other authors like James Turnbull, who just routinely cranks out tomes.
Yeah.
I'm like, how do you do this?
Yeah.
And then Ren Daniels and Jennifer Davis and Effective DevOps, like, holy crap, that was an amazing book. They both wrote it together, which is already an insane feat. Yeah. And it's big. It covers a lot of stuff. And like, I look up to people like this. And before I started writing mine, I was looking at people like, wow, this is the sort of stuff that I want to do. And now that I'm having done a very shorter version of that, it's even more impressive what a lot of these authors are able to accomplish.
Yes, absolutely. It is.
I'm very much glad I wrote a book. But the process of doing it is pretty crappy.
Yes. I always compare it to childbirth. Like, actually, you know, once the baby's there, it's like, oh, totally worth it. Amazing. I'll have another one. But, you know, when you're in like late stage labor and everything hurts and you're just like, I will murder everyone in this room immediately. it's a hindsight is much lovelier vision.
So
before we move on, I want to just highlight, like, I think one of the things, like you saying, you know, Jennifer, who, she's my colleague and I love her. She's fantastic.
Yeah.
She cranks out books and everything. And it's just funny, like, how to the outside world, I probably look fairly productive and put together. And then, like, I'm sitting in a room where there's like a pile of stuff that I need to put away. There's unfolded laundry. There's toys everywhere. Like, things are just a disaster. It's like, I feel like I'm not functioning at all. It's funny how we compare our other people's highlight reels to our bloopers.
Yeah. Like, I would love to see like Stephen King's process, having been writing for 30 plus years, I'm sure it's not that clean. Like, I'm sure you look around his office and he's probably in just as bad a shape as we are.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, on that note, you mentioned on Twitter a while back that, and what got me reaching out to you to have this episode.
Yeah.
You mentioned some, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, all you said was just like a hint of an idea that you see a parallel between legacy code, railroads, and subways.
Yes. So I wrote this abstract. It's the talk I want to give this year, and I have to figure out who might actually be interested in it. But it's talking about maintaining our legacy systems by comparing them to the first subways. So I believe London was first, the Underground was first, then the Metropolitan Subway in Paris, and then New York City. And at this point, we are dealing with century-old train systems that were sort of haphazardly put together. and they've over, like, the engineering feats that these initial engineers actually overcame during the building of these is fascinating. So if nothing else, like, go listen to some podcasts about just the first subways. But for instance, there is a subway station in Paris that is underground, but actually suspended. It is on an underground bridge, because the Plaster Paris queries. I always screw that up. Because the Plaster Paris quarries are so deep, going back to the Romans, that there are these massive holes underground. And so they built these enormous structures to hold these trains and stations up.
That's incredible.
That kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. And then New York deals with so many problems just because, I mean, some of the electrical wires that we still use for communication are insulated in cloth, if you can believe that.
I had a house like that.
Did you really?
I really did.
How do you make that? That just sounds like impossible. And a fire hazard?
I mean, it absolutely is a fire hazard.
Okay. Solid.
So there's this in the 1940s and, you know, I guess back to the 20s, there's this type of electrical wiring setup called knob and tube. And it's like the cloth is wrapped in wax, and then you wrap the wire connections in that. So you're not actually wrapping it in cloth, but of course, over time, the wax breaks down.
Yeah.
So at which point, everything just sparks and catches fire.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I mean, if you look at, I think rats cause a bunch of problems in the New York City subway.
As it turns out, rats really like electrical lines.
I know. It's fascinating. but yeah, I just think it's really interesting how we take these ideas, we execute them without really knowing what we're doing, of course, because just like the first time you write a book, the first time you write code, it's not going to be beautiful.
Yep.
And then we typically, 90% of the time, never get back to actually fixing it. I mean, I think if we're honest, probably most companies have a corner of code where like someone's like the new employee orientation is just don't touch that. If you touch that, everything breaks. No one knows how this works. It's written in Cold Fusion. just don't touch that. And so I think it's important to have a respect for the initial engineers who actually did something that was really hard, even though now with hindsight, those decisions may look bad. They were making the best decisions they could with the data they had at that moment. Mm-hmm. And then how do we, with that understanding and respect for them and the systems they produce, update and maintain them and maintain all these, you know, availability, reliability for our current customers. So I think it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, that is really interesting. If you're interested in more about the London Underground history, I think there's a documentary on, I want to say Netflix, about them building the first underground.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's super cool. I really enjoyed it.
So, I'm going to write that down.
Yeah.
I'm a documentary nerd.
You seem to have a flair for this, the parallel stuff. I was looking at some of your talks just recently on, and you did one on building teams and how it relates to Sparta.
Yes.
And I'm it was really cool.
Thank you. I'm glad. Yeah, this is my contribution to tech. It's like, I have a humanities degree. I went to school for political science. I love history. Mm-hmm. I wrote for so many years. So I like books and that kind of thing. So I think every talk is somewhat related. Like I have Humpty Dumpty Guide to DevOps, the Sparta talk, Dr. Seuss's Guide to Code Craftsmanship.
Which is also really great.
Thank you. There's a pattern here. Yes. I have a shtick and I'm sticking to it. I'll just say that.
Bravo.
Thank you. Yes.
Well, that sounds like it's going to be a really awesome talk. I'm looking forward to seeing it on stage wherever it gets selected. And I guess for anyone listening to this, if you have a conference, please invite Emily.
Yes, that'd be lovely.
she has a talk.
Yes. That'd be awesome.
Thank you so much for joining me on this. This has been absolutely fantastic.
Thank you so much. I've had a wonderful time chatting with you.
Yeah. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Yeah. So on Twitter, I'm editing Emily, like writing and editing. And you can find my website at emilyfreeman.io.
All right, then. Well, and thank you for all the listeners for listening to the Real World with DevOps podcast. If you want to stay up to date on the latest episodes, you can find us at realworlddevops.com and on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever it is you get your podcast. I'll see you in the next episode.
This has been a Humble Pod production.
Stay humble.